Yes, sir, Singh replied. If I understood it myself, he thought. The fury at everyone and everything that had followed the attack had faded, leaving behind only a vaguely unsettled feeling, like the adolescent fear of forgotten homework, like there was something that needed to be done, something that would cause trouble if it wasn't. But he had no idea what the thing was, or even how to find out. Any time, sonny, Trejo said. Singh took a deep breath that stuttered a little. He hated that it did. It was my feeling at the time that failing to respond to the attack on my person, and by extension on the authority of the High Council and the Empire itself, would only serve to embolden any dissident elements here on the station. I felt that a strong response was needed to enforce the message that this was now our station, that we weren't going anywhere, and that any attempt to hinder our work would fail, end the idea of a rebellion before it could begin. And you believe Colonel Tanaka didn't understand or support this position? Trejo asked. She counseled a more conciliatory approach. I believe her experience in the Martian military guided her here, but that it was not experience that translated well to this new situation. She disagreed, and stated that she would not support the new security measures, deeming them too harsh. I relieved her at that point. Why did her considerable experience not translate, do you think? Trejo asked. The words could have been taken as mocking or rhetorical, but something in the old man's voice made it seem like genuine curiosity. If there's no cover, the only thing to do is charge. How did he keep finding himself in these situations? Singh cleared his throat. Colonel Tanaka learned about rebel pacification by dealing with a belligerent but unaligned population. The Belters were not citizens of Mars, though they fell under Martian influence and regulation. To some degree, winning hearts was always part of the mandate. She still thinks that way. She wants to approach this insurgency in that way. Crack down on only those involved in the attack, and attempt to win the cooperation of the rest of the populace through kindness. You disagree with this assessment, Trejo said. I do. By mandate from the High Council himself, all humans are citizens of the Laconian Empire. The people on Medina are not a neutral third party placed between us and an insurgent faction. They are Laconians, and the insurgents are not a foreign government resisting conquest. They are criminals. Any other reaction defies the imperial mandate and legitimizes them. I don't need to win their hearts. I need them to understand that all the previous political bodies and relationships are irrelevant. We are not conquering new territory. We are enforcing the law in our empire. Trejo smiled. That could have come straight out of a political theory class at the academy. I wasn't asking for a book report, Captain. Do you believe all of that is true? It was a strange question. I wouldn't be here if I didn't, Admiral. It is certainly the official position of the Empire, and accurately stated, Trejo agreed. Sir, if that's all, why? Trejo asked, as if Singh hadn't spoken at all. Did the High Council place you here, do you think? Sir? Your educational credentials are impeccable. I have read your paper analyzing Duarte's theories on empire through logistical control, and I'd bet even he was impressed. You attributed some truly unique ideas to his text that I'm pretty sure aren't actually in there. Thank you, sir, Singh replied, trying to keep it from sounding like a question and failing. But you did exactly one tour on a naval vessel prior to this posting. And there are probably 100 more like me and Tanaka on Laconia who have actual combat command experience. Why you, and not any of them? Singh had wondered that himself. I honestly can't answer that, sir. And that's the only right answer, Sonny. No, you don't know. But I'm going to give you a hint. Do you know how to polish a rock?
No, sir.
You put it in a tumbler with a lot of other rocks and some sand, and you roll them around for a couple of weeks until all the edges are worn off and they're nice and shiny. We're taking control of 1,300 different worlds, and we've only got 100 old farts like me and Tanaka and a couple thousand university-educated greenhorns like yourself. Singh had no idea what a greenhorn was. It sounded like a Mariner Valley idiom. But the context was clear. And so was the point. Colonel Tanaka was placed here to... Singh started. To rub some of the stupid off you. Tanaka's been fighting insurgents since before you were born. She's killed more people than you've met. But we've already got a Colonel Tanaka. Putting her in charge doesn't create anything new. Hopefully this little dust-up has knocked some of your edges off, or this will be a waste of everyone's time. Tanaka's scheduled to fly out in an hour. I think you owe her a conversation.
Yes, sir, Singh replied. It tasted like more bile in his mouth, but the Admiral was right.
Trejo rose. The meeting was ended. Dismissed, Captain. Make sure Medina's still here when I get back.
Understood, Admiral.
The bravest thing would have been to go to the Tempest. The easiest thing, to record a message and send it through the Medina system where the security measures would forgive not having the conversation in real time. He split the difference. The Belter whiskey that someone had left in his old cabin on the storm tasted like acid and mushrooms, but Singh drank it anyway. The alcohol seemed to finally cut through the last of the bile in his mouth and throat. He kicked his boots off, propped his heels on his desk, and waited for the knot in his chest to loosen, even if only a little bit. It should have been obvious from the start. Looking back on it, the only thing Singh had to recommend him for the governorship was his absolute commitment to High Consul Duarte's vision. But that's all they'd asked from him. They needed to take the inexperienced true believers like himself and drop them into the deep center of the lake, then hope they learned enough to swim back to shore. And everything about Tanaka, her arrogance, her contempt for his inexperience, her refusal to just accept his orders at face value. All of those were exactly the reason she'd been placed under his command. Throwing her out in a fit of pique was the sort of adolescent behavior they were trying to burn out of his system. He had fucked it up. The fact that Admiral Trejo understood that he'd done it in the blind panic that followed his first time under fire was both a relief and a humiliation. It was also probably the only reason he hadn't been relieved of command. Trejo saw what had gone wrong, and still felt like Singh had something to offer. That he wasn't fit for the rubbish bin just yet. Comforting and humiliating again. He took another drink of whiskey. It left his throat warm. That was about the best he could say for it. That was enough. There was another trap ahead. Singh found that he could sense it. He could feel Trejo's attention, waiting to see how he'd navigate his way out now that his mistake had been made clear. The Admiral had practically ordered Singh to speak with Tanaka before she left, so that's where the trap lay. He had a dozen different impulses about what that conversation would be, and he second-guessed every one of them as quickly as he recognized them. This was his command, so it was his to lose. Maybe the right thing was to be willing to fail honorably.
Even if he did get sent home to Nat and the monster, the disgrace would be less if he knew he'd done the fully adult thing. He pulled the screen off his wrist and flattened it out on his desk. "Colonel Tanaka, video and voice," he said to it. "Tanaka here," she said a moment later. On the small screen, her face was compressed down to only the most prominent features. Dark, heavy eyebrows, wide jaw, flattened, slightly off-center nose. It made her look dangerous and angry. She was probably both right now. "Colonel," Singh said, trying to keep his tone even and informational. He thought he mostly succeeded. A call to finalize some trivial bureaucratic details. "Governor," she said, actually achieving the emotionless affect he was only trying for. "I spoke to Admiral Trejo about your transfer. He said he was happy to move you into a command position on the Tempest, and I did nothing to dissuade him from this. Thank you for not attempting to torpedo my career," she said, not sounding grateful at all. The fact that she didn't say, "Fuck you, little man, you couldn't have hurt me even if you wanted to," was as polite as this was likely to get. "I want you to know that I recognize that in my heightened emotional state following the attack, I made some poor decisions, not least of which was removing you from your command." There was a pause, a fraction of a fraction of a second, but it was there. "Really?" she said. The large eyebrows moved up a millimeter. "Yes. And if I could take that back without compounding my error, I would. But the most important thing now, to both my staff and to the citizens of Medina, is the appearance of calm authority at the top. To make so drastic a move as relieving you only to rescind it would make me appear weak and indecisive. So your transfer will be recorded as a move to put additional combat experience on Admiral Trejo's staff, now that we've secured the station and he's moving into the attack on Sol. It will not put a blemish on your outstanding record. Unfortunately, my apologies and regrets will have to remain unofficial for now." Tanaka frowned, though it looked more like surprise than anger. "I appreciate that, Governor. Good luck and Godspeed in Sol, Colonel. We will all be waiting for word of your mission success. Singh out." He closed the connection and drank off the last of the terrible Belter whiskey. He wasn't sure if it was the alcohol, but he felt like a weight he'd been carrying ever since landing on Medina was lifting. This was his station now. His command, to fail or succeed at entirely on his own merits. And now he felt that the worst mistake he was likely to make was behind him, and it hadn't actually been all that bad. Things could only get better from here.
Chapter 21. Holden. Rather than leave them sneaking into and out of the refugee camps in the Drum or Laconian-assigned quarters, Saba gave Holden and the crew access to a smuggler's cabin, a six-rack berth his people had carved out of a service tunnel where the station records were out of date and missing. It was a tight fit, and Alex snored a little, but it was better than the alternatives. The room where they spent most of their time had been meant for mid-level storage, not the deep pockets of the generation ship traveling through the vast abyss between the stars, not the immediate day-to-day pantry of the men and women whose lives would begin and end in the journey without seeing either end. Built-in yellow guides marked where crates of tools and imperishable rations would have been stacked along the deck and walls. History hadn't taken the room that way. Cushions of gel and fabric covered the floor around a half-dismantled holographic display that acted as a low table. The air recyclers were set to minimum, to keep the usage footprint of the space as low as it could be, and a battery-driven fan moved the thick air. Lengths of printed textile, Holden couldn't tell if it was cloth or plastic or carbon mesh, draped the walls and rustled in the little breeze. He didn't know if those were functional somehow, or if the impulse to decorate interiors just outlived all political circumstances. Mostly it reminded Holden of a Moroccan restaurant he used to go to on Iapetus, back when he'd been hauling ice for Pure and Clean. Saba and four people Holden assumed were his lieutenants sat across from him and the crew and refilled their cups with a smoky tea whenever they got low. In addition to being captain of a supply ship called the Maleclipse that was stuck in dock just like the Rossi, Saba was married to Drummer. At first, Holden had been worried that what he'd done with Freehold was going to haunt him, but when he brought it up, Saba had waved it away. "It happened in a dream," Saba said, which was a little confusing until Naomi told him it was an old-timey belter idiom for "don't worry about it." Even after a long life spent outside Earth's gravity well, Holden was impressed by all the things he didn't know. "Perdon," a belter woman said, squeezing her way past the guard of the door. "Saba, are you ready for food yet?" Saba mostly managed to keep his smile polite. "No, caro. Bis bien." The woman bobbed her hands, nodding like a belter. She swept her gaze over the rest of them, but paused a little at the Rosinante's crew, Holden, Naomi, Bobby, Alex, Amos, and Clarissa. "Any of you? We've got mushroom bacon." Bobby cracked her knuckles meditatively. Holden was pretty sure that was a sign of annoyance. "That's fine," he said. "We're good. Thank you." The woman bobbed her hands again and squeezed back out. It was the third interruption of the morning. That was a little strange, but Holden put it down to a level of general anxiety for everyone. With the occupying force settled in, the freedom Saba's underground had to operate was thin as a razor blade, but everyone still wanted to be doing something. "I'm sorry," Holden said, shifting which leg was folded under him. If he was always going to have one leg asleep, better to alternate them, he figured. "You were saying?" Saba leaned forward. It didn't seem like sitting on the cushions made his legs go to sleep, but he was younger than Holden by a decade or two. "We need to find balance, Sasa. The more of our own that we build, the more there is for us to use, but the more there is for them to find." One of Saba's lieutenants, who'd spent the morning arguing for building a fully separate comm system by threading hair-thin cables through the water system, cleared his throat. "The way I see it, we serve three masters, making space for ourselves, making tools for ourselves, and keeping space and tools from the inners. We have 3% of Medina now set where security can't see it. We have support from the crew. We have transmission out to and back from Solgate. Have to look at the margin of what we risk against what we'd get from it. All I'm saying." "Well, sure," Holden said, and Saba tilted his head. In his peripheral vision, Bobby leaned in. When he looked over at her, her expression was empty, but he had years of experience to tell him she was evaluating something. A threat, maybe, except that she was looking at him. Holden shifted his legs again. "It's just that anything we do, we have to assume it's temporary, right?" "Can't build on stone out here," Saba said with a grin. But Holden was pretty sure he hadn't understood the point he was getting at. "Medina is our station," Holden said. "We know it better. All the niches and passages, all the undocumented features, all the tricks and doors and corners. And that's going to be true right up until it isn't. These people aren't dumb. They're busy right now, and maybe they'll stay that way for a while, but sooner or later, they're going to get to know the station. Our advantage only lasts for as long as it takes them to learn, So, whatever we do here, it shouldn't be planning for the long term. We don't have a long term. We've got a short term, and maybe a medium term. Like maybe. Saba shifted, sipped his tea, and nodded.
Good point, Koyo, he said. Maybe also we start looking at evacuation plans. How not to spend a long life in a jail cell or a short one in an airlock.
Whatever goals we pick, Houghton said. I just don't think we should spend the extra effort to make it something that's going to last a decade when we're probably looking at less than 8 or 10 weeks of freedom. The way he said it, it sounded like an apology.
Saba rubbed his palm across his chin. The room had gone so quiet, Holden could hear the hush of the man's stubble against his hand, even over the whir of the fan. 8 or 10 weeks of freedom. It was the first time anyone in the meetings had guessed at the time frame. Whatever little apocalypse took out the underground, Holden expected it would be less than a springtime back on Earth.
It's fair point, Saba said, as a noise came from the corridor. Voices. A thin-faced man with a scar over his left eye leaned into the room, looked around, and nodded.
No reports from upstairs if you want them, Scar-Eye said.
Doesn't look like much of anything new. Checkpoints still on the move. And they put some stupid Koyo in their public prison for being out after curfew is all.
I don't think, Saba began.
Bobby interrupted him.
Maybe you should.
We could take a break. Right, Holden?
Holden said.
Sure.
Saba shrugged with his hands.
Bien, huh? Maybe bring in some lunch, yeah?
The meeting shifted. It was all the same people in the same space, but the motion of it changed. Holden leaned in and kissed Naomi gently on the cheek. She leaned her head against his as if it were only affection.
What the fuck is going on? Holden whispered. Did I do something to piss Bobby off? Because I really try not to do that unintentionally.
Naomi shook her head so slightly he only felt it.
You'll have to ask her what's up, Naomi said, but you're not wrong. It's something.
The conversations in the room rose and shifted, swirling like birds. A word or phrase that passed between Amos and Clarissa got overheard by one of Saba's people, shifted what he was saying, and soon Saba mentioned it to Alex.
Controlling people is usually having stuff they want.
Don't want nothing, and they're pretty much just down to hitting you until you do what they say, became...
Was easier with the Inners because they wanted to get rich and make rich people toys, became...
What do these Laconia Koyos want, anyway? What do they think they'd do it for, yeah?
Everyone in conversation with everyone else, whether they were aware of it or not. Holden watched it, listening and waiting for Bobby to come over. If humanity ever developed a hive mind, it wouldn't be psychic brain links that welded it together. It'd be gossip and cocktail parties.
Hey, Holden, Bobby said, touching his shoulder. Can I borrow you for a minute?
You bet,
he said, hauling himself up from the floor.
Bobby slouched out toward the corridor, and he followed. The air outside the room was cooler and seemed less like it had just come out of someone else's lungs. The lighting was strung maintenance LEDs, harsh and bright. The walls were painted in a dozen different colors, guides to the pipes and conduits behind them. The map and the territory both. Bobby paused at the junction of a service crawl with the main corridor. Voices murmured behind them, too distant to make out, but present. As tight as the spaces were, she could have leaned against both corridors' walls at the same time, one with each shoulder. She flexed her hands like a fighter about to go into the ring. There had been a time when they'd first met that he'd found Bobby's physicality intimidating. Over the years, she'd grown in his mind into a place where she was only herself. Every now and again, he'd be reminded that she was a professional warrior,
and well-trained in violence. Her expression was intense, focused. She could have been thinking her way through a hard problem or restraining herself from a killing rage. The two looked similar with her.
"Hey," Holden said, "what's on your mind?"
Her focus shifted to him, and she nodded like he'd said something worth agreeing to.
"So, are you here to help this or hinder it?"
"Well," Holden said, "I would have said help until you asked me that, but now it's feeling like a trick question. Am I missing something?" Bobby put out her hand palm first, like she was telling someone to slow down, but it seemed intended as much for herself as for him.
"I'm thinking this through while I'm saying it, so just..."
"Got it," Holden said. "Whatever it is, take a swing at it. We'll work it out."
"Other people? People like me?
We can show up and maybe not have an effect.
That's not how it is with you. Either you're helping or you're holding things back. There's no middle setting."
A little discomfort tugged at him, and he crossed his arms.
Bobby, is this about you being the captain of the Rossi?
Because that hasn't changed. Naomi and I..."
"Yes," Bobby said. "It's exactly like that.
Look, you've seen all those people who keep interrupting the meetings, right? They're all just swinging by to be in the room for a minute. Even if it's something they could have done on hand terminals. Or not done at all."
"I know the ones you mean," Holden said. "But that's not me. That's absolutely you. James Holden, who led the fight against the Free Navy, and stopped Protogen from killing Mars, and captained the first ship through the Ring Gates. Brought people together on Illus in the face of 50 different kinds of shit falling apart. You're in the center of everything just by walking into the room."
"Not because I like it," Holden said.
"When you showed up, Amos and I were getting ready to fight our way into all this. But then there you were, and you got recognized, and now we're all sitting in the absolute center of the conspiracy. Even if I'd pushed my way into this, there would have been days, maybe weeks, of proving to Saba and his people that they could trust me. You got that for free, and the rest of us drafted off you. I came in as the captain of the Rocinante, and it wasn't enough to be taken as seriously as you got for free."
Holden wanted to object. He could feel the denials welling up in his chest, but he couldn't quite bring himself to say them out loud. Bobby was right.
"I have an idea how we gather intelligence on the Laconians," Bobby said. "It's the first step that we need. But we have to move quickly. Saba and his people? They think this is like going back to before there were gates. No matter what they say, they think this is going to sustain and become a way of life for them the way it used to be. Did you notice how they started calling the Laconians Inners?"
"Yeah, I did.
But you were right in there. We're looking at a really small window. So if we're going to do what I think we really need to do, it has to be your idea."
"Okay, a little lost here. Which idea of mine are we talking about?"
"I'm talking about you taking the operation I have in mind, waltzing back in there and presenting it like you just came up with it yourself." Holden didn't know whether to laugh or scowl, so he did a little bit of both.
"No, I'm not going to do that," Holden said. "You say what you need to say and I'll back you. But I'm not going to start taking credit for your proposals."
"If it's my idea, it'll be like when we showed up," Bobby said. "I'll have to fight to prove it. If you do it, they'll just listen. Coming from you will give it weight that just being the right damn thing won't."
A clank came from behind them, a hatch being opened or a tool being dropped. He didn't turn to look. The unease he'd felt before shifted, changed its nature, but it didn't go away.
"I don't like that," Holden said. "I hate the idea that you're being treated as anything less than me. It's bullshit. I'll tell Saba that..." You remember the last time we went out to karaoke with Giselle? Right before Alex and she called it quits? Holden blinked at the non sequitur. Yeah, of course. That was a terrible night. You remember the song she sang? Rapid Heartbeats? Sure, Holden said. Who was the singer? On the original, I mean. Who sings that one? Holden said. The band is Kurtadam. The singer's Peter something. The guy with the one steel eye. Peter Vukcevic, Bobby said, nodding. Now, who plays bass? Holden laughed, and then a moment later sobered. Right? Bobby said. Yeah, okay. I got it. I don't like it, though. I'm not more significant than anyone else. Acting like everything important has to go through me, or else it's not legitimate? I don't know. It feels like I'm being an asshole. Bobby put a hand on his shoulder. Her eyes were calm, and her smile was a straight line. If it helps at all, I'm thinking about all this as me using you as a tool to achieve my own ends. It makes me less angry that way. They talked for another 20 minutes, Bobby laying out her plan in enough detail that he could introduce it. He asked a few more questions, but he didn't need many. The sense of working together with her had a weird nostalgia, as if the gap between arriving at Medina and now had been years instead of days. Large, sudden events did that. They changed the way time passed, not technically, maybe, but as a measure of who he and Bobby were to each other, and to themselves. A month before, Laconia had been one background issue among thousands. Now it was the environment, a truth as profound as the EMC or the Union. More, maybe. Back in the meeting room, the food had arrived. Recycled wheat paper bowls filled with rice noodles and chopped mushroom bacon and fish sauce. It smelled better than it should have. Bobby went to sit by Alex and Clarissa, folding herself gracefully down beside them. Holden felt the impulse to go sit there, too, to be part of the family again, and could have, except he also sort of couldn't. Would he be doing it to help or to hinder? Because he couldn't do both. For the first time, he felt what stepping back from the Rosie had cost him. And still, he couldn't regret it. All well? Naomi asked, snaking her arm around his waist. You look thoughtful. Are there thoughts? There were a few, yeah, he said. Mostly that I'm a tool, but in a useful way. Naomi sat with that for a moment. Saba caught sight of them and waved them over. Two bowls with forks and bottles of beer were waiting on the low table for them. Should I be offended on your behalf? Naomi said. Nope, Holden said. You should come eat. Saba leaned forward as Holden sat. This is good. One thing we can say about Medina. The ingredients are always fresh. True, Holden said. But they're usually still fungus and yeast. Vat-grown bacon is, well, it's just its own thing. So, Saba, I had an idea I want to talk to you about. Chapter 22. Bobby. We can't place a physical monitor on the data connection to the Laconian ship, Holden said, just the way she'd told him to. Saba had chosen the people to be briefed, selecting them by some means Bobby didn't know and didn't care to guess. They were watching Holden intently. It felt weird that the role of the great James Holden, come to lead them to glory, was being played by the Holden she knew. Apart from the coincidence of naming, the two didn't have much in common. We need to passively monitor incoming and outgoing signal without detection. Mirror the data. 4-4, a tall stick figure of a man said. His name was Rames, and he was in Medina Station's technical support department.
According to Saba, he had the run of the ship, their insider on this mission. Bobby didn't like him.
Alisla thick with encrypt. Better off reading their coffee grounds.
Decrypting is a later problem, Holden said, not giving too many details of the plan away to any one person. Bobby had a decent idea, but she was still working out the details of how to get the decryption codes. The fewer people knew the details, the less likely it was to get out before she was ready.
Right now, we just want to get as much as we can so that we can decrypt it when the time comes. The important aspect right now is that we get the signal without anyone knowing it's happening.
Gotta look inside the pipe without touching the pipe, ¿qué piensa?
I've brought along my team leader and technical expert to explain the how of the thing, Holden said, nodding to Bobby and Clarissa.
Captain Draper?
Bobby gave him a wink only he could see. Say what you would about the man, he did take to the role of meaningless figurehead with panache. Bobby walked to the front of the room and pulled up a volumetric map of Medina on the wall display behind her.
The Nauvoo was intended as a generation ship, she started.
Fuck is a Nauvoo?
A belter woman asked.
The others chuckled.
Read some fucking history once, Saba said to her, then nodded to Bobby to continue.
They knew she'd be picking up signals from farther away than anything it ever needed to before, Bobby said. She zoomed in on Medina's comm array. So the comm system is massively overpowered, and much more sensitive than anything on a commercial or military vessel.
Ramez nodded and shrugged expansively with his long hands.
We don't even use most of that shit. No one talking from far away in here.
He meant inside the slow zone, and he was right. Nothing was ever more than 500,000 clicks from Medina. The physical boundaries of the space prohibited it.
True, but the equipment is still there.
And up on that comm array is a signal sniffer sensitive enough to track a single photon through a fiber bundle a meter thick, Bobby said, zooming in on the technical map behind her.
But we can't just steal it.
Claire?
Clarissa pushed herself out of the corner she'd been hiding in and came to stand next to Bobby. She wore a mechanic's jumpsuit with the name Tachi on the back, and her hair pulled into a tight bun. With her gaunt cheeks and sunken eyes, it made her look severe and impatient.
Even though this array isn't in use, Clarissa said without preamble, it's still hooked to the primary comm system. If we start unplugging things, alarm bells are going to go off up in ops, so we need to put the circuits into a diagnostic shutdown before we physically yank the parts.
Faconians all over in ops now, Ninita, Ramez said, watching everything all the time, them.
Clarissa nodded her agreement, then said, and that's where you come in. We need to get you onto the ops deck to shut down the panel long enough for us to do our work, she said. And also, if you call me little girl again, I will hurt you.
Is that right, Ninita?
Ramez said, his grin turning condescending.
No, Bobby said, stepping toward him. No, that's not right. Pulling that gear will be delicate work. I can't risk her damaging her hands before we get out there.
Bobby took another step into Ramez and stared down at him.
So I'll hurt you. Mao's my second on this. Don't make me beat some respect into you, Ninito.
She glanced over at Holden. He looked shocked and maybe a little sad. She wondered how he would have handled it back before. It was so strange to be doing all this in the same room with each other.
Ramez threw a look to his buddies on the crates. No one stepped up to back him up.
Saba was smiling and making a let's get on with it circular motion with his hand.
Sabe,
Ramez said, looking to the side the way abashed primates had since the Pleistocene.
Just for fooling, ¿qué?
Sasa,
Bobby replied,
then switched the screen from the volumetric map over to her mission plan. Here's the rundown, including precise times for each thing to happen. Mao and I will be on the outside of the station for most of this, and we can't afford to do any broadcasting out there, because the Laconian sniffers will almost certainly pick it up. I'll be calling up to Ops using an unlocked hand terminal that Ramez here will get for me, Holden said, nodding at the man as an invitation for him to nod back. We're picking a time when Daphne Cole is the duty officer. She knows me now, and I'm thinking she'll understand what we're trying to do without me having to explain it. Calm discipline is in full effect. The assumption is everything is heard by everyone. So that call between Cole and Holden is what we're all listening to, Bobby said. We'll pass out a list of code words Holden will use during the call as signals. This is our only method of coordinating the action, and there's no way for us to signal an abort or call for help. Our backup plan is everyone does this right the first time, so we don't need a backup plan. Understood? Lot of risk for a dump of gibberish we can't make sense of, Ramez said. Bobby felt a little flush of annoyance at the man. The more we have, the more likely we find what we need in it when the encryption problem gets fixed, she said. We start where we can, and that's this. Are we all clear? A murmur of Dewey and Sabe and Sasa rippled through the room. Outstanding, Bobby said. Let's get to work. The slow zone, or the ring space, or the gate network, no matter what you called it, it was fucking weird. Bobby and Clarissa exited the drum section of Medina Station using an old maintenance airlock that Saba swore wasn't monitored from ops. They were wearing emergency vac suits, the so-thin-they're-barely-there type, whose only purpose was keeping the wearer from dying of asphyxia before help could arrive. They were bright orange and yellow, to make the wearer easy to find in smoke or against the black of space. They had large, flashing lights on the helmet and shoulders to aid rescue workers, but Bobby had smashed those with a wrench before they put them on. Bad enough to be a brightly colored blob climbing up the outside of the station. No reason to flash a distress signal, too. Under normal circumstances, going outside a ship or station wearing the emergency suits was asking to be cooked by radiation. The cheap throwaway suits had almost no shielding to them. But the slow zone was fucking weird. There was literally no radiation in the ring space that humans didn't bring in with them. No background radiation. No solar wind. Nothing. Just a massive, unnaturally black void all around, defined only by the distant and faintly glowing rings equally spaced around it, and the blue sphere of the alien station at the center, where they'd had the railgun emplacements. Bobby and Clarissa rode the outside of the massive, spinning drum section of Medina inside the old airlock. The indicator of their motion being the occasional distant ring moving past the black window of the outer airlock door, and the fact that something kept trying to shove them out the door at a third of a G. Bobby had them both tethered to a clip inside the airlock so they wouldn't be hurled into the strange non-space outside. A large rectangular structure whipped past the outer airlock door. Bobby pressed her helmet to Clarissa's and yelled so that the sound would conduct directly. That's one of the exterior elevators. We go for the next one. Clarissa nodded, wide-eyed, and braced for the jump. Outside of the drum section of Medina, two structures ran the entire length of the ship from the engineering deck aft of the drum to the ops deck in the bow. They housed machinery, conduit, and a pair of elevators for moving from one zero-G section to the other without passing through the drum itself. Bobby and Clarissa planned to use one of them to climb the station up to the comm array on the nose and back down to the Laconian ship docked at the stern. Bobby opened the mesh bag at her hip. checking again that she had everything the same way she had a dozen times before. Spare air bottles for herself and Clarissa. They'd be outside for hours making the long climbs. A magnetic grappling gun with high tensile cable and a winch, and finally a fat black recoilless handgun that one of the belters had managed to hide from the Laconian weapon sweeps. If they actually needed to use it, the mission was fucked anyway. But there was a dignity in going down fighting that appealed to Bobby's romantic notions. She hooked the emergency cable on her suit to a loop at Clarissa's waist, then unhooked herself from the airlock. The station tried to throw her out the door, but she grabbed the lip of the outer airlock with one hand and held on. In the other hand, she held the grapple gun. Behind her, Clarissa had one hand on her shoulder and one hand on the bulkhead. 3, 2, 1, go! Bobby shouted, hoping enough sound would travel up Clarissa's arm. She launched herself out the outer airlock door by releasing her grip on it, and was shooting off into the void at 3.3 meters per second. The massive rectangular structure of the maintenance shaft rushed toward her, and she fired the magnetic grapple into it as she passed. If the grapple failed to connect, they'd keep flying off into the empty space of the slow zone until they ran out of air, and their lifeless bodies eventually flew into the eerie curtain of black at the edge of the alien space. Dangerous, but no more so than a challenging free climb back on Mars. She didn't even think about it. Her eye spotted the place she wanted the grapple to go. Her hand and arm did the rest. The grapple landed less than a half a meter from the spot she was aiming for. Like riding a bike. The grappling line and the leash that connected the grappling gun to her suit snapped taut and pulled her in a fast arc around the maintenance shaft, dragging Clarissa helplessly behind. Bobby started up the winch, pulling them closer as the speed of their arc increased. Just before impact, she bent her knees and activated her mag boots. The landing was going to hurt a bit. She hit the metal surface of the maintenance shaft like the tip of a whip being cracked and let the impact fold her knees up into her abdomen. Clarissa slammed into her back, and it felt like someone dropping a bag of cement on her from a couple stories up. Bobby rolled with it, slapping the decking with her hands to activate the glove magnets, and hung on. A few punishing seconds later, they were on the side of the maintenance shaft, all the violence of their motion gone, having been converted into lightly sprained knees and a collection of bruises. "Ouch," Bobby said, and floated motionless for a few seconds, tethered to the shaft by only one gloved hand. "Yeah," Clarissa replied, faintly, through the helmet she had against Bobby's back. Bobby pushed her helmet against Clarissa's. "It's a long climb, but at least there's no gravity to fight. You up for this?" Clarissa answered by unhooking the tether and pulling herself up the flat, gray wall of the shaft. "All righty then," Bobby said and followed. 2 hours and an O2 bottle change later, they floated near the massive Medina Comare, a bewildering cluster of antennae, dishes, and radio broadcast towers, and at its heart sat a laser powerful enough to send messages back to Earth from 100 light-years away. It had never been used. "I remember when that almost ended all human life," Clarissa said, pressing her faceplate to Bobby's. "It doesn't look so scary now."
"I've heard that story," Bobby replied. "Wish I'd been here to back you guys up in that fight."
Clarissa shrugged. "The story's more fun than the actual experience was. You didn't miss much." Clarissa pulled herself over the rigging of the Comare, coming to a stop next to an oversized receiver dish. She pointed at an access panel below it, then flashed the belter sign for "this one." Bobby nodded with one hand, then tapped the side of her helmet. "Now we wait for word from Holden." She turned on the small emergency radio in her suit, already tuned to the channel Holden would be using to call Daphne Cole up in station ops, and waited. Clarissa stared at her across the vacuum between them, motionless and patient as a hunting cat. The minutes dragged. When her radio crackled to life, Bobby found herself grinning. "Medina Control, this is work crew Kilo Alpha. Do you copy?"
Bobby could only hear Holden's side of the conversation, so there was a long pause, and then his voice again.
"Copy that. Can I get Chief Cole on the line? Gotta route some repairs through her office." Office was their code that meant Ramez was outside of ops, waiting for permission to enter, so the plan was proceeding, and waiting only on Cole's cooperation.
"Hey, Chief. Good to hear your voice again,"
Holden said, hitting the words hard. He hadn't identified himself by name, and he wouldn't. If Daphne Cole didn't pick up on what was going on, they'd scrub the mission. If she raised the alarm, well, that would be an interesting problem.
"Working with Saba down here on electrochemical. Tracking a grid problem that Laconian death ray caused, and we'd love to pull a panel up there to really nail it down."
And here's where the most dangerous part of the plan happened. It wasn't flying through space on a tether, or climbing up the outside of a massive station wearing the thinnest and crappiest vacuum suits. It wasn't even going to be later when they climbed down to the Laconian ship to hook in their signal sniffer, hoping no one was watching the outside of the dock. It was here, where Holden was counting on his voice, Saba's name, and the mention of Laconians to signal Cole that they were up to no good, and needed her help. And more than that, counting on her Belter pride being stronger than her fear of execution by their Laconian masters. Because if any of those things weren't true, Cole could refuse them, and that was the end of the plan. Or worse. Bobby waited a very tense minute of radio silence, and then Holden said,
"That's great. I've got a tech heading to ops to pull that panel, if you can let him in. He'll take a gander at our glitch and get out of your hair."
Gander. Code for go in five.
"Copy that, Chief. We appreciate the patience while we sort this out."
Bobby gave Clarissa a thumbs up, then flashed her five fingers. Clarissa nodded with her fist, then started pulling tools out of the mesh bag at her hip. First thing down, Bobby thought. Just a 2-kilometer climb aft and planting a bug on a Laconian destroyer without getting caught left to go. With Medina Station functionally motionless in the slow zone, it was less of a climb than a mag-booted shuffle down the 2-kilometer length of the maintenance shaft. Bobby pulled the blocky module containing the field strength sensor on a short leash behind her. It didn't have much mass, but she'd taken it without conversation when she'd looked through Clarissa's visor and seen the technician's complexion going a sickly gray. Other than jumping out of a rotating airlock, they hadn't done anything particularly taxing, but it was pretty clear that Claire was already running on fumes. As they got closer to the engineering and docking bay section of Medina, the Laconian ship came into view around the curve of the station. Bobby couldn't help but whistle her appreciation of the beauty of the thing. Say what you would about Laconian authoritarianism, their engineering included a lot of aesthetic beauty in its design. The destroyer, Holden had called it the Gathering Storm, looked like a natural crystal formation that someone had chipped into a knife. The colors were all translucent pinks and blues, faceted like a gem. She spotted something at the tail that probably served as the ship's drive cone, but didn't look anything like the UN or Martian design she was familiar with. The nose of the ship ended in a pair of sharp projections, like a dagger point with a channel cut down the center that left her almost certain it was a railgun. If the ship had torpedo launchers or PDCs, she couldn't see them. The ship was so strange, so unlike anything humans had ever designed or flown before, that if it had docked and green three-eyed aliens had walked off, it would have felt more appropriate than the humans that actually flew her. Clarissa stopped and turned, so Bobby yanked the sensor array to a stop on its leash, then pushed their two helmets together. "There," Clarissa said, pointing to a maintenance access hatch that looked exactly like 100 they'd already passed. "That's the router that feeds from the dock into the station network." "You're sure?" Bobby said, looking around at all the other hatches. Clarissa didn't answer, just rolled her eyes and took the leash. She pulled the sensor array down and attached it to the hull, right next to the hatch. She pulled a few leads from the box and plugged them into slots inside the hatch, then stuck a hand terminal on the side of the array and spent several minutes going through what looked like menus. Bobby replaced both of their air bottles while she worked. A few minutes later, Clarissa stood up and gave her the thumbs up. Bobby looked over at the massive blade of the Laconian destroyer. If anyone on it had seen them working, the ship itself gave no hint. Clarissa walked over, holding her hand terminal, and touched it to the side of Bobby's helmet. Her HUD snapped on, and a wall of text rolled past. The signal traffic between the destroyer and the local decrypt facility, complete with routing flags and timestamps. It was still locked behind military encryptions, but everything that the Gathering Storm sent down to Medina and everything it got back was here, and the underground was skimming a copy of all of it. "Huh," Bobby said to no one. "I honestly thought that would be harder." Chapter 23. Drummer. The ship came through the ring like an old video of a whale breaching the surface of the sea. The 1,000 kilometers of the ring gate was tiny in the scale of the solar system, huge by human measure, and the Laconian battleship fit between the two. Too large to be comfortable in one, too small to fit well in the other. Its design seemed to come from the same uncomfortable place. Neither the now familiar eeriness of the protomolecule, nor the history of human manufacture, but both and neither. Drummer watched the observations feed again and again, and it made her skin crawl a little every time. She wasn't ready. Rock hoppers full of gravel were burning hard for positions that didn't matter anymore. The EMC fleet was consolidating around the inner planets and the Jovian system, but with days, sometimes weeks, left on their burns. The void cities were looping down to meet them. All of it preparation for tactical situations that weren't on the board anymore. Duarte and his Admiral Trejo had stolen the tempo. She had to make sure the price would be higher than they'd intended to pay. "Madam President," Vaughn said. Drummer watched the Tempest emerge through the gate again before she spoke. It was astounding to her that something so large could make it through the gate at all. It looked big enough to break the safety barriers with its own mass and energy. Maybe there would have been a way to use that with Laconia the way they had with the Free Navy. Except that the fucking thing was already through the gate. "Vaughn," she said, not looking back at him. "Communications is asking for your decision on the repeater," Vaughn said. She took a deep breath, let it out slowly between her teeth. There were thousands of radio signal repeaters scattered through the system, but she knew which one Vaughn meant. Their clandestine traffic to and from Medina, Avasarala's gift to her, ran through a low-energy repeater that was floating dark outside the ring gate. From Medina, its signal was weak, and the wavelengths it jumped among similar enough to the gate's usual interference that it was easy to overlook. From normal space, it was more obvious. And the closest ship to it right now was the Tempest. She could order her communications forces not to use it. That was easy. But the EMC intelligence forces also had access to it, and Saba's underground. The more people who could make a mistake, the more likely that something would go wrong. And it was easy enough for her to shut it down. One signal packet would do it,